This podcast includes unapologetic logic and reason and may not be suitable for all audiences. In a world full of nonsense, he's been called the voice of uncommon common sense. He sees the abnormal that many find normal. Author and award-winning speaker, he is Chris.
Welcome back to the Christopher Scott Show. I know we're a day late and a few hours late here for the Tuesday show, but I figure it's better late than never. I told you I wasn't going to be back on Monday. I said there was a chance I might be back for Tuesday. And over the weekend, I had some material I really wanted to get into. Was hoping to go ahead and find the time to do the Monday show anyway, but it just didn't happen. And then Monday got just overwhelmingly busy for me. I was out of town for the weekend. I had an engagement. Got back very, very late Sunday night, which is what began to throw things off. I was expecting to be back a lot earlier. That's why I thought I'd have time to do the Monday podcast. Get back, and it was just a rush all day getting ready for the Project Chaos radio show yesterday. And I got to tell you something. Yesterday was episode number 17. If you're listening to this show, I think you'd appreciate what we discussed yesterday. You want to talk about some deep state nonsense. I was talking about the Stuart Scheller story. Well, the broader topic was that I get asked as a veteran a lot, you know, what do I think is the situation in Gaza? What do I think is the situation in Ukraine? Are we headed for World War III? People ask me these things all the time. You know, what do I think militarily? I don't know. You know, I was a Lance Corporal for most of my career, barely made E4, you know. I wasn't the commanding general of the Eastern Theater or whatever. I don't know. It's not like I have all this information at my fingertips to really know. However, that being said, it's not like I walk around with my head in the sand either and you have a little bit of sense of what's going on. As I dug into it a little bit, I think we got a real good sense of what's going on. And the main thing that I was talking about was these goofy changes that the military is implementing, these literal regiments and all these new terms, because everybody's a bunch of idiots and the grand puppet masters. They create these new terms, which does nothing but try to elevate them to some nonsense. And here's the problem with the whole thing on an integrity level. Generals, while they're in command, make a lot of money, okay? They get a big salary, they get all kinds of perks, and they walk around and they get their royal butts kissed everywhere they go. I don't think the average civilian understands. You know, when the general walks in, boom, you better snap too, right? And that's the expectation. And every once in a while, they'll, you know, walk around and you'll hear stories of them, you know, whipping on some Lance Corporals or something like that. Not literally, but, you know, whether they didn't have their belt on or they weren't keeping uniform standards or blah, 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 blah. But what I've come to realize in all this, that I think since about the time of Al Gray, maybe there was others I just don't know of, but we've steadily moved in the direction where the generals have gotten politicized and don't really give a rat's behind about the rank and file or what's going on militarily. All they're doing is building their own careers. And my evidence to support that is what they do after their service. Specifically, I pointed out that Mattis, General Mattis, is now working for Yemen. Our border is wide open. Lieutenant Colonel Schiller, I told the story yesterday. If you don't know that guy, he's the one that spoke out openly. Active duty Marine spoke out openly about the command failure on the Afghanistan withdrawal. They threw him in the brig for that. Threw him out of the Marine Corps. Now, this was Marines doing this, to be clear. I want to get their names. I'll tell you, I went on a tear yesterday. I asked, I said, well, you know, Scheller is over here getting a raw deal. Where's Mattis? Lining his pockets with Yemeni's money. That's where he's at. What happened? What happened to the oath to our Constitution? Whatever happened to the commitment to our country? And I'm sure if you asked Mattis, he'd give you some nonsense about how it's in America's foreign security interest. Yeah, really? How? Do you know we're sending money to Yemen? Probably billions. I don't really know. Mattis is over there. How much does all this get skimmed off the top? He says, oh, I don't like the way you're saying that. Oh, you don't? You're going to tell me there's no perks. Mattis is so used to getting his royal behind kissed all over the United States, you tell me it's any different in Yemen? I don't think so. So we pay him while he's in. We pay him while he's retired. Great. Good for him. What's he doing for our country? What's he doing for the Corps? Very little, as best I can tell, if not anything. Matter of fact, he might very well be working against our interest at this point, best I can tell. And let me tell you something, the point that I made yesterday, These generals have cast a shadow of doubt on their integrity. And it's their doing, not my doing. I'm not the one going out and taking contract jobs after active duty. I made the point yesterday, you know, Yemen is over there working for, Mattis is working for Yemen. Well, we have an embassy in Yemen, and there's Lance Corporals that are standing guard duty out there. Every day they got to go out for long shifts, standing on their feet, and they got to look sharp, follow orders, expected to follow a very strict regimen. They don't get to participate in any of these spoils. Mattis just sticks it all in his own filthy pockets. That's a real problem. You think that the Lance Corporals are so stupid that they don't see this stuff, but they are seeing it. And everybody's had about enough. Anyway, it was a great show. Hope you get a chance to check it out. On another front, something that I've been thinking about, and I think I mentioned a few times on here, that this could be really wildly interesting as I've played this out a little bit. And generally speaking, that story is the story of whistleblowers. We did some shows on Project Chaos where we had some VA whistleblowers on, one of which I know very well is from my unit. These guys' lives were virtually destroyed by their efforts to speak out, just like Lieutenant Colonel Schiller, and I see that as the biggest crime. How is it that a Marine, of all people, full of integrity, hell-bent on exposing the truth, and gets penalized by that? In some cases, by the very Marine Corps that he signed up to participate in, such as Schiller. Well, he was in the boys' club, and the boys, when he said, hey, something's wrong here, they all turned their backs and ran. What kind of Marine is that? Those Marines in command of Schiller, they're the ones that should be relieved of their commands, not Schiller. They all should be relieved. Their names should be published. Their integrity is gone. Their name is absolute mud in military circles, and that's not happening. I'd like to change that, quite frankly. But the other thing that I want to talk about, I said generally, the plight of the whistleblowers. I spent 4 years active duty Marine Corps, got out, spent, you know, whatever, 20 years in the private sector. And for 14 years, I worked back in the public sector, quietly behind the scenes, because that's kind of how you do that. You know, you don't get into public sector work to run your mouth and create a platform. I don't know anybody that's doing that, least of which me. I actually, whatever it was, 15 years ago now, when I did get into the public sector work, it was because of some business changes that me and my business partner were going through. You know, we had a business. I was employed by that business. He had a separate business. He worked part-time in our partnership. That was the arrangement. And then the situation changed a little bit where he needed a salary, and his situation was a little bit different. So I decided, and there was other reasons behind all this, but I decided to give up my paycheck in our partnership, if you will, and allow him to fill that position. I was going to go get a job. This was 2010, I guess. And, you know, we had the real estate partnership. We were making money, but very difficult times and all that. I mean, we had good years. I mean, not so good years. So, you know, you didn't know. And you had to plan for that. And by the time 2010 had hit, you know, we had gone through the whole 2006, 7, 8 banking crisis, and it kicked us around a lot, but we were surviving. We were getting by. Anyway, I said, I've had enough. I'm just going to go get a job for a while, cover the bills while we build our real estate empire. And, you know, a lot of equity, you know, great equity in our properties, but cash flow is always challenging. So I go get a job, and just kind of by accident, I end up working for the town that I was living in at the time. I take this little job as an apartment inspector. It's 35 hours a week. It was perfect for me. I had a business. I was very busy with that. 35 hours a week was ideal. It didn't pay a lot of money, but we had prepared for all this. We had kept our living expenses very low and said, all right, this will work out just fine, and it did. And in my mind, I got to know, I said, I'm just going to take this job for a year and, you know, just to figure out where we're going to go with all this. And we were talking about selling the real estate and, you know, all kinds of things going on. And I didn't know how it was all going to pan out. I was just going to wait and see. It was actually one of my neighbors, a guy living behind me, who was my boss, who hired me. It worked out perfect. I had a real estate background. I knew building, construction, codes, all these different things. So this apartment inspector job was interesting and a very fascinating position, by the way. And I did that. I filled that position, I think, for a little over a year. And I inspected, I don't know, a couple thousand apartments in that time. You want to talk about getting a little education at the peak people's lives. And one of the most things that I remember stands out. So remember, I'm building my real estate career. I'm driving a used car. You know, I'm still living in my entry-level home that I move out of. And the purpose of all that was to keep living expenses low, saving, so we could buy the real estate. Going in and doing all these apartment inspections, one of the things that I noticed is that they all had flat-screen TVs, every one of them. And I didn't own one at that time. That was in 2010. It was amazing now, 2024, and you don't see anything but flat-screen TVs. How many TVs in this country ended up landfilled in that process? Think about that in the past 14 years. Just in TVs. Monumental when you think about it. The amount of money spent in the transition from tubed TVs. And I'm not complaining. Have you ever had to move one of those behemoths? You had to have kids today, they don't know. We had to have a crane come out and boom that thing over the roof. They get into the living room. Today, you just carry in a little flat screen. Nobody's even doing that. The flat screen TVs we have in our house today, we project from our phones. It's crazy, really. Crazy how the whole thing's just completely changed. But anyway, that was one of the things that stood out for me. All these people that are renting, they all had the latest TVs. I'm like, well, you know, I'm living lean and trying to build a business. Anyway, I ended up falling in love with it, and I stayed. And I fell in love with it because I realized that there was a real problem. I'd spent my whole career on the other side of the regulatory line, fighting with building inspectors and zoning officials and whatnot. And there I was. I had become one of them. I spent about 9 years doing that, code and zoning work. And I did it because I loved it. I didn't enjoy it at all, really, in terms of, satisfaction of the technical part of the work. It wasn't really my thing. But what I really did love was helping people through the permitting process and getting things built. And we did great with that. And where I'm going with all this, to kind of make this a little quicker, around the 10-year mark or something like that, things changed. The politics changed. And one of the things that happened is it became one-party rule. And it started to go down very, very badly. And I want to tell the truth about what's happening in these local governments. I want to talk the truth about what's happening to the good people that are there. I don't care about me. This isn't going to be a poor me story. To be honest with you, they squeezed me out and the jury's still out, I guess, a little bit, but I just got a phone call today. Again, it looks like it's going to be the best thing that's ever happened to me. I'm glad, actually. I think that the time had passed that I needed to get the hell out of there, and I was just, for some reason, clinging to it that I didn't need to. Anyway, long story short, I have this idea to just expose these stories, whether it's the Scheller story or it's local government stories. And as I'm processing all of it, I want to do a show on what I experienced. At least one show. I might do more than one. And this is going to be embarrassing. For those of you that don't know, here in the town that I live in, I worked here for a little bit as well. I switched jobs. 14 years, I worked 12 in one jurisdiction, 2 in another. And I happened to be living in both. When I went back to the other job, and I noticed that the politics had just went to crap. But when I left for a little while, working for the town that I live in now, a little closer to Philadelphia, the corruption was overwhelming. The millions and millions of, this is a town, a local budget, a town of about 25,000 people. It's not a huge, huge budget. What's the total budget? I don't know, 20 million or something like that. And there's millions being misappropriated, big money. And I did a video, just like Lieutenant Colonel Scheller, a little bit different. I never spoke in the video. It was their testimony from public meetings. They went in there in 1 year and said one thing and came back the next year and said something completely different. And even the board members themselves, because they were fighting about the money, they all wanted their piece of it. And best I could tell, the board president and the manager just kind of pushed it in a certain direction. And there was a little bit of a fight over that with some of the other board members. And they wanted, where's this money? Why can't we use it for this one? And then the blah, 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 blah started. Nobody could answer, where's the money again? They couldn't answer that question. And if you watch the video, it's insane, the back and forth. I don't understand what this $1 million, it was there, now it's not, and you're telling me. It was all very, very confusing, and it was never made clear. They just came back and adopted the budget. Well, I took all these little clips. This is hours of public meetings. I took these little clips, and I put it all together. Now, you can say, well, I was taking it out of context. Oh, no, I didn't. I put it in context, I'll tell you that. So then the next part was getting anybody to watch the video, right? Nobody's going to watch this. You know, Chris reveals missing millions. No, nobody's going to miss it. The papers wouldn't talk to me. So what do I do? This is going on and on. hurricane tornado hits our town, and I create the title of the video, Upper Dublin Tornado Blows the Roof Off of Missing Millions. It took off. Thousands and thousands of views. And it doesn't go away. They've begged me to take it down. I won't take it down. Not going to come down. Just let it burn. And the same thing will be when I do a podcast exposing the truth. Let me tell you something I found in my insider work being inside of government. The liars do not like to be exposed. It's embarrassing for one thing. And it attacks their very being in a sense. And they'll fight with all that. And it becomes very sinister, very evil. And there can be a little bit of a backlash. But I got a little surprise for you that I know many people aren't going to understand. And that's this. I like to fight. You got to understand something. I volunteered to go in the Marine Corps. When it came time to deploy, I wanted to be advanced party. While we were there, I constantly volunteered to go to the furthest points, go on the outposts. And I'm not going to sit here and act like I was in the hottest spots of whatever, because I wasn't. I'm just telling you, when there was something to be done, when there was a fight to be had, I was there for it. And I still am. And I'm not afraid to take it on. As I think about the whole thing, I thought, wow, this could be an incredible direction for the show. So we'll see what happens. It's easy to have big ideas. We'll start one step at a time and see. But that show's going to be coming. I'm getting very excited about it. By the way, I have some other people who are willing to come on, other inside employees that are coming. I thought, man, I bet you more and more would be the same thing as the veterans. It'll be a small group that trust me and say, yeah, I'll come talk to you. Anyway, I want to talk about a few other things here because the country is really going to hell in a handbasket, if you haven't noticed. And we got to really pay attention to what's going on. This article is fantastic. This is from the Gateway Pundit, Wayne Root. He's one of the writers for them. He said, my warning to President Trump, this crisis and chaos in America is all about Obama. Get ready for what's coming next. Hint, Michelle Obama. You hear more and more about this. This is very interesting. He says, let's put two and two together. Start with what's happening in America at this very moment. The anarchy on college campuses. It's not brain-dead Biden. It's all Obama. Why do you think it's all centered around Columbia University? This all started at Columbia University class in 1983. He says, I'm a witness. We were taught to hate America and support socialism and communism. Even back then, all my Columbia classmates wanted death to America. We were taught Cloward Piven, the plan to destroy America, the U.S. economy, the great American middle class, and of course, capitalism. So let me talk about this Cloward Piven strategy a second, because this was not invented by Obama. But I'll say to you, this goes a lot further. But let's just stick with this a second. And this is from Wikipedia, okay? So don't accuse me of putting any slant on it. Cloward and Piven were both professors at the Columbia University School of Social Work. The strategy was outlined in May 1966 in an article in the liberal magazine The Nation titled The Weight of the Poor, A Strategy to End Poverty. The Cloward-Piven strategy is a political strategy outlined in 1966 by American sociologists and political activists Richard Cloward and Francis Fox Piven. The strategy aims to utilize militant anti-poverty groups to facilitate a, quote, political crisis by overloading the welfare system via an increase in welfare claims, forcing the creation of a system of guaranteed minimum income, and redistributing income through the federal government. Cloward and Piven's article focused on subversely compelling the Democrat Party, which in 1966 controlled the presidency and both houses of Congress, to, quote, redistribute income to help the poor. You heard Obama talk about that. They stated that full enrollment of those eligible for welfare, quote, would produce bureaucratic disruption in welfare agencies and fiscal disruption in local and state governments that would, quote, deepen existing divisions among elements in the big city Democrat coalition, the remaining white middle class, the working class ethnic groups, and the growing minority poor. To avoid a further weakening of that historic coalition, a national Democratic administration would be constrained to advance a federal solution to poverty that would override local welfare failures, local class and racial conflicts, and local revenue dilemmas. They further wrote, the ultimate objective of this strategy, to wipe out poverty by establishing a guaranteed annual income, will be questioned by some, because the ideal of individual social and economic mobility has deep roots. Even activists seem reluctant to call for national programs to eliminate poverty by the outright redistribution of income. Here's a simple question for you. As I share all this, is this good or bad that you hear going on? Now, I know many of you listening, oh, it's bad. It's bad. Socialism, it says. But some of you listening, well, shouldn't we be helping the poor? Shouldn't we be compassionate? I mean, just because somebody's deaf and dumb doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to eat. Do you agree? I do. I think we should be compassionate. And the idea of a basic minimum income, I think it was, I don't know, Thomas Paine, Ben Franklin, the early framers talked about it. A very similar conversation. Let me tell you the very simple problem with it. Very, very simple problem with it. I am totally for it. Totally for it. Except it has to be voluntary. When we voluntarily supported the church by tithing, when it was practical to do so before the federal government so overtaxed us that it's now begun to attack our very religious foundation. No, it's destroyed it, really. Why do you think? People aren't giving their money to the church. All of their disposable income goes to the federal government for wealth redistribution. As long as it's voluntary and willing, it's good. As soon as they begin forcing and taking, it's wrong and it's bad. On top of that, whatever else you want to say about all this, even if you wanted to agree it's good, it's sound, it's going to be done in a good way, look at how corrupt and inept our government has become. Do you seriously want any expansion of that? Let's see. Who was my college classmate back at Columbia? Obama. The weaponization of government and persecution of Trump, that's not brain-dead Biden. It's all Obama. That all started with Obama's presidency. True. Obama used the NSA and CIA to spy on Trump and then frame Trump with fake Russian collusion, just like the fake trial going on in New York right now. Take note, President Trump, this is Obama going after you. Obama also used the IRS to destroy his critics and opponents. He says, I'm a witness. I'm one of Obama's victims. Obama used the IRS to try and destroy my life. The IRS was his personal goon squad. Obama used the IRS to threaten, intimidate, and terrorize conservatives and conservative nonprofits. When I went public and exposed Obama on Fox News, guess what happened next? Hundreds of GOP donors who had written checks to Mitt Romney's campaign contacted him to say they were also victims of IRS attacks only days after writing a check to Romney. You know what this means? I wonder if Romney got scared. You know what this means? Obama used the IRS to rig the 2012 presidential race. Obama was the most illegitimate president ever. And I'll tell you something else. I'm not going to read this whole article. You can go find it at the Gateway Pundit if you're interested in it. But I look at all these things going on, right? Look at the attack on beef. Who hates beef? Muslims. Who is anti-free speech? Muslims. Is there gun rights in Muslim countries? No. Are there any personal rights in Muslim countries? No. The entire attack. And Obama, what he did, is he convinced the world that everybody was united against white people, that white people were the enemy. Pretty interesting, right? Well, maybe it's time that we start pointing to Muslims as the enemy. If we're going to separate into tribes, right? And say, hey, Obama, I saw you over there. You know, if just like Warren there, Obamsky, if Muslim is the enemy, you got a little bit in you. That makes you Muslim as far as I'm concerned, right? You ain't white. The boy ain't white, right? You want to make it a war? Okay. Well, now we know who's on what side. Obama's not on the side of America. He talked about this wealth redistribution. And you know what? You might be for it. You might be against it. It's already happened. They're already rolling out the checks. It's the new system. Going to be what people do with it, how people use it. It's going to be determined who's going to come out of it on the other side. Let me go into some of these other stories. That's kind of my big picture view. Whether or not Michelle Obama is going to pop up, I'm not really seeing that. I hear this keep coming around. It's getting very late in the race here for any of that to happen. And I think it'll be very funny. I also was thinking back on something else with Trump. There's a very weird situation developing here. That does not seem very democratic to me at all, quite frankly. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Let me use this little analogy to explain what I see going on in politics. I don't know if this will make sense. I was down in South Carolina last year for a Marine Corps reunion. I drove down there with a good buddy of mine. We took a little road trip. We had a mutual friend that we were going down to see down Hilton Head. We made a road trip of it. And it was really phenomenal. And he's an incredible driver. I used to work with him back in the day. That's how I know him. I got in the Marine Corps. We worked with him for a while. Got to know him that way. We just stayed good friends ever since. And he's supported the radio show. Helps me with the radio show. It's really been phenomenal. Well, one of his claims to fame is the way he drives. And he drives me down to the radio show. And there's a lot of traffic going down into Philadelphia. And every time we get out, he's like, look in the mirror. Nobody behind him. Nobody. He just has a way of opening up the road. And I learned some driving techniques for him. And let me just see if I can explain this very, very briefly. You ever noticed if you're in the right lane and traffic's just moving? Let's just say it's moving 45 miles an hour, right? It's pretty thick traffic. If you're in the right lane and you just begin to slow down, what happens? You might get the one or two rammy people that blow by. But if you notice, everybody will naturally just slow down. You've heard me talk about this. It is a herd mentality, or another way of putting it would be monkey see, monkey do. I've made the case, you've made me hear me saying this, that I'll be coming home, the certain route that I come home, I come down this 45-mile-an-hour road, there's a wide shoulder, I got to make a right turn. It's right after a light. And it's downhill, so it's fast, is my point. And I got to make a right turn. So to be cool, I always put my signal on early, and I move over onto the shoulder so the fast-moving traffic can keep going. Well, I can't tell you how many times people will begin to move to the right with me for no apparent reason other than they're following me. So, what does this have to do with politics? Well, I believe a lot of politics is the same. You know, it seems to me, and I watch this going on, where, you know, I see Republicans saying that the Hamas protesters should be jailed for saying death to Israel or whatever. I say, well, what happened to free speech? Well, it doesn't include if you're calling for killing people. What? You need to step back and reanalyze that. They want to make it a criminal penalty to tear down the posters of Israeli POWs. You know, they're being held by Hamas. Now, don't get me wrong. I find it as detestable as anybody that you're going to tear that down. These people are still being held captive, for God's sake. You know, we know who the enemy is. But as far as making that illegal and jailing people for tearing those down, that sounds a lot like North Korea to me. And today it'll be tearing down the Hamas posters. And tomorrow it'll be the tranny sticker. And pretty soon you're going to have people round up in gulags just like Russia is going to be the result of that. I keep trying to say this. It's like the Second Amendment. You either have it or you don't. And we don't right now. You want to call what we have freedom to defend yourself and a freedom to arm yourself. Certainly not in New York City. They just openly say it now. They don't have it at all. Anyway, back to the driving and the politics. There's a herd mentality. People are going to see monkey see, monkey do. Well, if you understand how that works and you can play it and time it a little bit, you can exercise phenomenal control. Now, this is coming from somebody who drove very rammy for years because somebody would hit their brakes and slow down. I'm like, what the hell's going on? I'm going to be ramming up there and getting nowhere. Well, what I learned is sometimes, you know, say you're getting in a heavy pack of traffic and the left lane's not moving and the right lane's not moving. Well, you slow down a little bit, get a little fat, bounce around in the lane a little bit, and everybody will start to slow down. And get it slowed up a little bit, and then punch the gas and shoot the gap. Maybe as a light's about to turn red, boom, leave them at the light, that kind of thing. And you can really open up the road like that. And you say, this is kind of sinister. It's not, really. If you look at the way, and I'm telling you, the traffic flows around is so much better as a result of this driving style. Instead of getting all rammy and getting right up on people, no, you just back off. We're coming back. We're up in Connecticut. I said we were traveling over the weekend. We come back 150 miles out, and I'm doing 80 in the left lane. Here comes some dude roaring right. I mean, roaring up on me. I'm like, how fast is this guy going? You know what I do? Quick bump over to the right of lane. You go. And then I saw him get up there a couple hundred yards or whatever and jam on the brakes because of blah, you know, and then boom, jam on the brakes, how I used to drive. And I think I saw him up at the next exit, but that's not the point. He opened up the lane for me. And so once you realize how all this works, it's kind of magical, really. And I kind of laugh because I look at everybody else driving. I'm like, what a bunch of idiots. They don't know. They don't know. But neither did I. Well, here's what I want to tell you. I think Obama knows how to ride the political momentum. I think he's cracked the code. And he understands that you can create a fight, that you can create a distraction, and that it can be very effective at getting something done, even if it's against what people want. Very sinister when you think about it, the way we're being manipulated. I don't know if you can blame him for all of it. He didn't write this, but he certainly subscribes to it, and he certainly seems to be helping move it along. And there's no transparency. Nobody's really discussing it. We're just supposed to believe that these hooligans up at Columbia have our best interest in mind. Maybe we ought to get their names. Maybe those are the people that need to be rounded up. I don't know. Just a way of thinking. It doesn't seem very American to me what's coming out of Columbia. God willing, I'll be back tomorrow. I sure hope to see you there. Got a lot to talk about. Make it a great day.